McCarthyism and Joseph McCarthy and his anti-communist agenda tied that very much to an anti-gay perspective, and he viewed and framed gay Americans as anti-American, as dangerous to the United States.
That's Lisa Stolberg, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Lisa Stolberg is Associate Professor of Sociology of Education at New York University. Her research focuses on the politics of race and education, affirmative action in higher education, school choice policy and politics, and LGBTQ social change. She joins us to talk about her latest book, LGBTQ Social Movements. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here.
You write in the introduction to this book that it's designed to serve as an introduction to LGBTQ social movements. So what are readers going to find here?
I teach a class at New York University to undergraduates about social movements in the U.S. since the 1950s. And I wrote this book initially for my students and for anybody else as well who might be interested in learning a bit more about social change around gender and sexuality over the past 60 or 70 years in the U.S. There's a lot of interest in these topics now. We're in very changing times politically with respect to all kinds of politics, but particularly these politics. And what I was hoping to do with the book was give an introductory and thematic look at some of the primary struggles for social change by the LGBTQ community. So with a focus on lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer organizing. And my hope is that it will include some material that people may know something about, like the Stonewall Rebellion in the late 1960s, which we could talk more about if you're interested, and that will also include some material that folks may not know very much about, like organizing around bisexual identity and transgender identity. There's also a chapter in the book on youth organizing and on young LGBTQ people and their experience in schools and their activism around their schools. And I also have a particular interest in thinking about the role that culture plays in social change. And so one of the themes of the book, and something we should be talking about more in my view, is the role that art and popular culture play in social change movements of all kinds. So that's a primary focus of the work as well.
Well, I do want to come back to the Stonewall Rebellion that you mentioned earlier, because many people do see that as the beginning of the gay rights movement. But you point out that it really started before then. So tell us about that.
Sure. So this is a lesson that I've learned from other scholars who have studied this, that I think a more accurate starting point for the modern, what was then the gay rights movement and is now the sort of broader LGBTQ movement, is World War II. What other scholars have written about is that World War II was a point when people from all over the country who had been isolated in their small communities and might have had same-sex desires or a sense of themselves as potentially different with respect to gender and sexuality, but sort of isolated, came together and found each other in the military. And so the military really became a community for gay and lesbian people. And then after World War II, people stayed in touch with each other and had built these identities and communities. And the first gay and lesbian rights organization started in the early 50s. So really right after the post-World War II era. And it's not something that we tend to think about. And there was a lot of repression during this period as well with McCarthyism and Joseph McCarthy and his anti-communist agenda tied that very much to an anti-gay perspective. And he viewed and framed gay Americans as anti-American, as dangerous to the United States. And that was a perspective that had a lot of traction in the late 40s and early 50s. But at the same time, gay and lesbian Americans who had served in the military and who were starting to get a sense of themselves as a group and as a minority group that could fight for rights, fought against that in a collective way and started to really come together and form organizations well before Stonewall. So there was a lot of organizing in that post-World War II period that we don't read very much about typically. The Stonewall riot or rebellion or uprising was a response to police repression and brutality. There's a bar in the West Village that's still there. I walk by it almost every day on the way to work called the Stonewall Inn. It was a gay bar in the 60s that was raided by police on a fairly regular weekly basis. And this particular night in June of 1969, the patrons in the bar fought back, and that led to a multi-day response to and fight against the police in the village. And that came at a time when there was so much activism in the United States around so many different kinds of marginalized minorities that it was a moment of heightened activism, and it really did spark an organizational revolution for gay and lesbian rights initially and gay and lesbian liberation. And so we tend to think about that as the start of the modern LGBTQ movement. But I do think we need to set the clock back almost another 20 years.
You mentioned that this came during a time when there was a lot of other sort of social revolution going on and protest. What do you think the sort of the gay rights movements have in common with other social movements?
I think, one, these are overlapping communities, so everybody has multiple identities. So there were LGBTQ people in the feminist movements and in the movements for racial justice, of course. And in the early LGBTQ movement, there were people of color and women and others who were thinking about and organizing around other parts of their identities. So one, they're overlapping communities. To the gay liberation and gay rights movement at the time really directly took some lessons from particularly the racial justice movements, the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement at the time. They looked to the strategies that civil rights activists were using to make change. They looked to the language. One of my favorite examples, it seems like sort of a small one, but I think it's reflective of something larger, which is there was a gay rights activist in the early 60s who coined the phrase gay is good, and he was drawing directly on the sort of alliterative phrase also black is beautiful, and sort of taking this identity that has been stigmatized and turning it into an identity of pride. And so really the earliest gay liberation activists, gay rights activists, were learning direct lessons from these other movements at the time.
In the book, you talk about this division between assimilationist and liberationist throughout the history of the movement. Explain what those positions are and why there is this sort of antipathy between the two.
This is something that I hopefully talk about in the book in a way that makes this distinction complex, but it's a distinction that we tend to use when we think about this movement and many other social movements. Assimilationism tends to be a focus on entering into and assimilating into the mainstream American institutions and culture, and tends to focus on using American institutions like the law for social change. So it tends to focus on civil rights, tends to focus on assimilating into existing institutions. Liberationism tends to see those institutions as fundamentally problematic and broken and not really able to authentically incorporate in difference. And so liberationism tends to be more about building alternative institutions and really providing a strong critique of American institutions and American law. There's a lot of complexity to this, but that's a distinction that I think makes sense to think about ideologically. I think it's particularly interesting to think about that in the context of the question of how much can we really think of the law as being a tool of social change, and what are the limits to legal change? And that's a question that I think we get from liberationists who are very interested in critiquing the sort of foundations of American institutions and recognizing that those are probably not going to provide the full measure of liberation for marginalized communities.
Well, it seems like this would then come into play with the whole idea of same-sex marriage in, you know, do we conform and try to assimilate into this whole idea of marriage and how it's recognized, or should there be something else?
Right. And the marriage movement, we think of that now as being one of the primary focuses of the LGBTQ movement, but it is a relatively new focus for the movement. And while the conversation about marriage has been on the agenda since the early 70s for LGBTQ people and activists, it really only was central to the LGBTQ civil rights movement starting in the 90s. And that conversation from very early on was about, is the institution of marriage something worth assimilating into and worth opening up? Or is it kind of fundamentally itself patriarchal institution and a problematic institution? And this is a debate that we see play out still to this day with the conversation about what is gained and what is lost by marriage equality. And I think it relates back to a sort of broader conversation within LGBTQ activists about whether sameness or difference is the thing that should be focused on in the movement, whether asserting, oh, we're just like you and marriage just means opening this institution up in a way that will be not really changed fundamentally what the institution is, or asserting difference, that there's a fundamental difference between LGBTQ identity and straight or cisgender identity and the relationships that come out of those identities.
You noted in the book that when you teach your class on this topic to undergraduates at NYU, they don't understand why granting equal rights to LGBTQ people is so controversial. So what's your take on that? Does it give you hope for the future?
It does give me hope for the future. So my students are young, or a lot younger than I am, and they've lived in a time when, for instance, marriage equality has always been part of their reality, if not nationwide, that at least through part of the country, that having the freedom to love and marry who you want has always been part of their reality. They've lived through a time when they've had the option to join gay straight alliances in their schools. Those were started in the late 1980s, so well before my students were born. They've lived through a time of increased cultural visibility for LGBTQ young people. They see TV shows and movies a little bit less, but definitely TV shows and music and art and theater where LGBTQ characters and storylines in a positive way are front and center. And so they're living in a time when there's still a lot of homophobia and transphobia in schools, and we know that through studies that are done every year in climate studies of schooling. So it's not that this issue of the marginalization of LGBTQ people has been solved, but there has been so much progress and relative quick progress. And young people, we know from social science, just tend to be more open to diversity of many kinds and are less interested in labeling themselves and their friends and their peers. And so there's just an openness. And I think I have a bit of a skewed sample, and then I think New York University tends to draw a fairly liberal group of students. And my classes, which teach about social movements, I think even more, you know, draw students who are fairly liberal minded. But I think this for them is a given that LGBTQ equality is something that we should be striving for. And that does give me a lot of hope. We've seen other signs of youth activism around many issues in recent years that also give me hope, like the Black Lives Matter movement and like this recent movement for gun safety and gun control that the Parkland young people have gained so much attention for. So I do think that young people now have so many platforms for and are so savvy about using those platforms for social change that they're really inspiring.
Lisa, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much, Dan. I really enjoyed it.
Lisa Stolberg's latest book is LGBTQ Social Movements. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. On Facebook, you'll find us at KPR Conversations, that's all one word, and you can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.